Hello, everyone, and welcome to Think Change, a podcast from ODI where we discuss some of the world's most pressing global issues with a variety of experts and commentators. I'm your host, Sara Pantuliano, ODI's chief executive. Today, I want to bring your attention to the crisis that is unfolding in the Horn of Africa. After four failed rains and with the threat of a fifth, the Horn is now facing the worst drought in 40 years. There are up to 20 million people at risk of going hungry. Actually, the current crisis is drawing parallels to the famine in 2011 that killed nearly 260,000 people in Somalia alone. We've seen aid agencies and food security experts warn about the possibility of a crisis for 18 months. And actually, they were already raising the alarm about the seriousness of the situation over 6 months ago. So why are we here again? And how bad is the situation likely to get? And what does it take to get crises such as this the attention they deserve in the media? So our panel today will help us understand what more could have been done to anticipate and mitigate the current crisis. And more importantly, what can be done now to respond? I have a great group of colleagues and friends with me to help unpack these issues. I'm really delighted to have with us Mary Harper, the Africa editor at the BBC.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's such a pleasure to have you here, Mary. We are joined from Mogadishu by Daoud Giran, the country director for Mercy Corps in Mogadishu. Welcome, Daoud.
Thank you for inviting me. It's good to be here.
Thank you, Daoud. And also Mogadishu, Nimo Hassan, the director of the Somalia NGO Consortium. Hi, Nimo.
Hi, how are you all? Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thanks, Nimo. And last but certainly not least, my colleague Simon Levine, Senior Research Fellow at ODI's Humanitarian Policy Group and a long-term Horn and Food Security Analyst. Welcome, Simon.
Thanks, yes, very nice to be here.
Great. Well, let's get started. I think it's fair to say that the risk of famine in the Horn of Africa is not currently headline news. In fact, I was reading in The Guardian that it looks like 80% of British people are totally unaware that there is a crisis. So let's try and understand how this is possible. You know, what factors are really shaping this silence in the news and what we can do to change that. But I think I would like to ask Daoud and Nimo to tell us a little bit about the situation on the ground. You know, give us a sense of the extent of the crisis. Daoud, maybe I'll ask you to start and then, you know, Nimo, you can add your reflections.
Thank you, Sarah, for asking me that question. I mean, the situation on the ground is really dire. We have already reports of famine situations in parts of the country. First time for many years now, Somalia has declared famine. The new president was on the ground last week. And, you know, it's reported that between 7.1 and 7.1, 7.7 million people are facing acute food insecurity. Of that, around 4.9 are people who are already, you know, facing worse situation than they were a few months ago. And the latest Fishnet report indicate that 250,000, around 250,000 people are already facing famine in many parts of the country. It's estimated that over the last few months, over a million people were displaced from their homes and now moved to IDP camps. And the situation is really there as it stands.
Thank you, Daoud. Nimo, can you actually tell us where in particularly, you know, this is bad and, you know, for which groups? I heard you speak at our event last week and you were giving us some quite interesting details on, you know, who it is on the ground that is suffering the most.
Thank you, Sarah. I mean, the whole country is actually in similar crisis at different stages. There are hotspots in Southwest states, where by Davao and around the riverine area, where you have poor communities who are pastoralists and farmers, and you know, due to conflict, COVID-19, the situation in Ukraine is actually exacerbating the situation. So elderly mothers and children are highly malnutrition, So the, a big part of the community, even in Jubaland, is also affecting, affected really badly. But I mean, it's the whole country, basically. 66 districts out of 74 are currently impacted by this drought. And definitely comparisons have been drawn between 2011 and 2017. But this crisis also, it means there's no, you know, it's different to previously because it means there's no, not much resources on the ground. These cries for support and resources are not being answered yet. And you've got the impact of COVID-19, which obviously impacts the whole global economy as well. And to top it up, you have the war on in Ukraine, which I think 90% of food comes from Ukraine or Russia to Somalia, which makes the situation even more difficult. Over to you.
Thanks, Nemo. So, Simon, Nemo is drawing parallels to the crisis in 2011, and obviously there have been, you know, other food security crises and famine in Somalia and the rest of the world. From your assessment, how does this crisis compare to previous crises, you know, like at this point in time? What would your assessment be?
I think the only crisis really to compare it to, for people of my generation, and that's 1984 in Ethiopia, and that is a crisis which obviously got huge global attention, media attention, the attention of pop stars and everything, which is why I think the comparison just really highlights the fact that people don't even know what is going on. I mean, if you look at the Horn of Africa, frequently rains fail there. We know that, and livelihoods are adapted to deal with that. When two rains fail, people suffer, but they get on with it. You only really ever have a famine when there's a war, and that's pretty much true right across the world. So 2011, there was a very, very quick famine. Only two rains failed, but because of conflict situations and because of difficulty in getting aid to people, you had about 250,000 people who died in Somalia. Those are the best estimates. In 2017, three rains failed. It was pretty bad. You didn't get anything like the mortality, and that's because aid went in much quicker and with huge scale up. Because people took it really seriously. This time, we've already had four failed rains. Yeah, that's pretty much unprecedented. And it's fairly sure that the fifth one is going to fail. We'll keep talking about that later. On top of that, as Nemo mentioned, you had COVID. And to understand what COVID means, it means that money wasn't coming into the country because so many from diasporas, people sending money back when they lose their jobs. And that is what provides work for people. When they don't have a harvest, you go to town, you work on construction. So all of that's dried up. So I saw a figure just at the weekend. I saw the latest figure from UNICEF is that in the Horn as a whole, so not just Somalia, but in the south of Ethiopia, and parts of Kenya, the total number of children with severe acute malnutrition at the moment is close to 2 million. Now, severe acute malnutrition doesn't mean that the child is hungry and needs a good meal. This is a medical definition of a child that needs an urgent medical intervention. Now, if all of those children were able to get satisfactory treatment according to international standards for humanitarian response, that means that 90% of them will survive. So even if we were able to get aid to all of the children who are currently in severe acute malnutrition, that means we can expect 200,000 children to die. Now, in this terrible famine of 2011 in Somalia, far fewer children than that died. Around 125,000 children died. So we are already baked in. We are already worse than 2011, I would say. And because the crisis has been going on longer, and we're not at the end of it. This one is going to run and run and run for at least until the middle of next year, probably.
Well, that's really sobering, Simon. Mary, you've reported on Africa for over two decades. From your point of view, what's different from previous crises?
I mean, listening to all the contributors so far, it's obvious that this is one of the worst crises that Somalia has had. I mean, one thing that as journalists we say, we always hook on to these rather dramatic statements like it's the worst drought in the Horn of Africa in four decades, things like that. But it is compounded by, as has been mentioned, the effects of COVID, the war in Ukraine, also I think the issue of the war in Ethiopia is another factor that complicates things. And the fact that in Somalia, the conflict is in no way anywhere approaching, there isn't really an end to the conflict there in sight. And I was in Mogadishu last month, and people there were basically talking about, they were remembering the terrible drought in the 1970s. It's called the drought of the long tail. And the people who had been through that, that's what they were talking about. And every day they were just looking up to the sky. And whenever they saw like one cloud, they were like, oh, maybe the rains are coming. And they just didn't come. And they didn't come. So I think that combination of the fact that it is very, very bad, the fact that the world is very distracted by other issues, and food, fuel, and other prices have been so affected by the conflict in Europe. This is like a perfect storm of something terrible that is happening. And as Simon said, looks like it's going to be going on for some time.
Absolutely. Simon, Mary was saying journalists need a hook. The obvious hook in this kind of situation is, you know, the F word, you know, the famine, but humanitarians are always very cautious of declaring famine. You know, we've heard agencies talk about famine-like conditions. You know, can you explain the impact of using such cautious language?
So the word famine used to be a perfectly normal English word, and we all knew what it meant. But then the problem came that people would throw the word around really as a way of trying to get money to respond to what was genuinely a crisis, but maybe wasn't really a famine. So the aid industry as a whole tried to systematize things and give things a precise definition. So on the one hand, people are very cautious about using the word famine unless very specific conditions are met. Those conditions do seem to be met in many parts of Somalia, not the whole of Somalia yet. But there's a lot of caution about using the word for two reasons. One is it's very, very political. Countries, for example, very often don't like the word to be used about their country. I mean, the reason why famine was declared in 2011 is it was declared by the United Nations, not by the government of Somalia, because that was in a very different political situation there in terms of transitional governments and so on, not like the government that exists today. Sometimes people are cautious about using the word famine because it makes everybody think of food and food only, whereas you get it when you get a situation of as many children as are dying, for example, at the moment, this isn't just about food. You need a health response and so on. So sometimes people are a little bit cautious. But I think in general, the caution is probably a little bit excessive. And as you said, Sarah, when people talk about famine-like conditions, what do they say? If it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. In this case, we should probably be using the word famine, yes. And perhaps one thing, other thing to say is that there's this idea then that if it hasn't yet reached a famine, that then the situation isn't serious. And I think that is a problem in the aid industry and the Mongolians as well. It's like things have been defined in these various phases. So phase three, for example, is a crisis, whereas phase five is a famine. Well, usually on most measures, if you've got a scale of 1 to 5 and you're scoring 3, things aren't too bad, are they? Well, actually, 3 means a really bad crisis. 5, a famine is so extreme that people then don't want to use the word. But the fact then that you haven't yet used the word, or you say, for example, as you know, as you said in your introduction, people are at risk of famine, it does make it sound as though, oh, things aren't really yet that bad. And I do think it's a good reason perhaps to get away from the word. In this case, yes, it should be used, but not to get too hung up on the word, because just because it isn't a famine doesn't mean we don't have an awful lot of kids dead.
Can I just say something? Like the media, if you call it a famine, there will be more media attention. Because once you call something a famine, unfortunately, journalists, they do go into this kind of stereotypical, urgent, kind of almost like, well, you might say white savior mentality in terms of the Western journalists anyway, of which I'm one. But they love using words like famine of biblical proportions. Mm. They go back to the 1980s, the famous BBC broadcast by Michael Burke when he went and saw people in biblical-like famine conditions. But even though that's an unfortunate way of reporting what's happening on the ground, it does trigger something for the media. And when, like, you've spoken very clearly about very various technical definitions, but when you do that, journalists just ignore it, I'm afraid to say. So it is a very tricky issue.
Yeah, I want to come back to this issue of savings, but I want to also hear from Nimo and Daoud how the famine declaration issue has been discussed in Somalia. You know, bring your perspective to this. I'm sure there must be a lot of discussion amongst the agencies there, perhaps, you know, different views. It'd be great to get a sense. I mean, Daoud, you represent an international organization. Nimo, you chair a group of national NGOs. Are there different views? Maybe I'll ask Nimo first.
Thank you so much. And just maybe to get a bit of a correction, it's both international and local that are part of the forum that I direct. I mean, I'm listening to Simon and Mary, honestly, and here I am shaking my head and thinking, why does this situation have to get to that extreme dire where millions of children are dying before it warrants, you know, attention from the international media? I think that itself needs to be deconstructed and looked at. And I think that some of that maybe we'll be discussing a bit later. The situation is dire. People are dying. One child lost to malnutrition or hunger is actually a failure on the system. At the moment, the agencies are talking about preventing famine, which I think is really good because prevention before cure. So that is the discussion that we're having internally, that we need to take action in order to prevent the situation getting into famine declaration. But the necessary resources aren't coming. As you said in your opening remarks, it's been 18 months, even a bit longer, when the alarms were sound of the looming hunger crisis that is affecting the communities that we're discussing. We also need to be talking about response that is, you know, that has dignity and putting the humanity back into humanitarian, taking away the political, the gimmicks and those headline grabbing. I mean, I understand that's what that's what the journalists need to bring attention to this, but I think we really need to move away from that. And people are dying at the moment. As Simon said, there are parts of the country where famine is actually being seen on the hotspots. It's not the whole country. If it means if declaring, and I think this is something for the government to decide now. But if that's what it's needed, then it should really be declared, because children are dying, people are dying at the moment.
Thanks, Nimo. Daoud?
Thank you, Sarah. I concur with all the explanations that were given. But first of all, I want to say I totally concur with Simon. I mean, declaring the chance to declare a famine always remain a domain for the government. And in particular in Somalia, because this remains very political, I think we have been in electionary mood for the last 1 year. And I'm glad actors like myself, Masiko, and other NGOs, through even the NGO consortium, we're glad to see now the new leadership this week appointing a special envoy on the humanitarian situation in the country and declaring a famine. So always, there's a lot of caution about where to draw the boundary as actors, whether it's the UN or NGOs. However, I think one thing that everybody realized is that even as Simon described, the IPC levels, classification even has got very little boundary between different stages. You know, a population can be at IPC3, in this month, and by next month, if there's no intervention, it can quickly move to emergency, which is IPC4. So I think that was one of the problems. And then, as Mary put it rightly, journalists are always, looking for that story that is capturing. So calling it famine-like situation often does not attract many of them, unfortunately. And many of us in the country and who are acting on the ground always felt frustrated that, we are going around things that we know are going to a worse situation. So as Nimo said, I think we all need to come out and look at things the way they are. I mean, the situation on the ground is there. I mean, over the last 18 months, many areas have been in IPC2, which is stressed, to IPC3. And now already we are seeing very severely affected pockets, which have now been declared as famine. Then finally, I just want to add and say also, I think globally, there have been a lot of other things that have been happening and drawing the attention away from this, the drought and situation in the Horn. And I think INGOs, the Somali NGO Consortium, and even to some part the UN have always tried to highlight this. But unfortunately, issues in, you know, happening globally have really attracted the attention. And I think it's the right time we now bring the focus back to you.
Thanks, Dawood. I'll come back to that, but I think we need to follow up on this saviorism issue. You know, you mentioned Band-Aid. I told you I was doing a lot of work really to try and, you know, decolonize our work, our language, our messaging. And I think it's really important that, you know, we think how we do that in terms of engaging, you know, with the language of famine, food crisis, and African narratives in general. So, Mary, I'll have to ask you, how do you think we can avoid this, you know, UK Eurocentric perspectives, the really virgin saviorism? I mean, you work with Somali journalists. How can we really make sure that we have a more, you know, rooted, appropriate narrative around this crisis?
I mean, one thing that might be a blessing in disguise is that Western media organizations are facing financial problems. And so you have fewer Western journalists on the ground in Africa, which actually might not be a bad thing, because now you're having more and more people from the continent reporting on their continent. And I've been working with a group of Somali women journalists who've set up a women-only media unit in Somalia. And they choose the stories that they want to tell, and they choose how they want to tell them. And even the Western media, the British-based Guardian newspaper, has gone into a kind of partnership with them, and it publishes their stories. But the editors there have been very clear. They're like, we do not want them to do a sort of Guardian-style Western approach. They have to tell the stories how they want to tell them. And these journalists, they definitely want to tell the stories about what's happening on the ground in Somalia because of the drought, and also because of increased food prices because of Ukraine, what we've gone over already. And it's interesting that I'm thinking about two stories that they've wanted to tell. One of them is actually, they want to talk about how it affects people who live in cities, because so much of the reporting is about like nomadic communities and all of that. So they've done an amazing story that actually The Guardian published, which was about how people in Mogadishu were affected. So they talk about IDPs, which is the kind of standard approach, but also they went and spoke to teachers who get $800 a month and they're struggling. They spoke to restaurant owners, they spoke to one woman who's having to close her restaurant because everything's too expensive, she has no clients. They spoke to shopkeepers, and in fact, one of the images, they took the photos as well, was of a closed shop door because shops have had to close because everything is too expensive. And then they also went on a Save the Children trip to Baidoa. And the way that they seem to want to tell that story is also different. Like, they want to focus on the journey that people make from their home areas to the city, how impossible it is, like they have to come on donkey carts, and in fact, their donkeys are dying. So then what do they do? Like, I never thought of things like that. So they are telling the story from a different way, an original way, a more genuine way, because they're Somalis. And also, like, for example, there's a photographer went from The Guardian, a British guy, but he was like, the Somali journalist was like his boss, really, because she was showing him what she thought he should take pictures of. So I think that kind of way of approaching this is much better. And it's good if it can get international coverage, not just in the Somali media, but it's really important. And also, I think that in terms of people, media consumers, the way that they might be more interested, because it won't be the usual story about drought and famine that they've read hundreds of times before. So I think it's really great that this kind of thing is happening, and actually that some international media are taking it seriously and giving space to that kind of local journalism.
Now, that sounds good. And something else I was thinking that has changed since 2011 is also, of course, you know, the ability to communicate online, and of course in Somalis in particular, are very present online. So Dawood, is that something that you are trying to leverage to, you know, how is this being played out on social media in that space to really try and increase awareness around the crisis?
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. I mean, you are right. I mean, we are trying to leverage on all people around in the country as well as those who are outside. I mean, media, definitely, as Mary put through, media plays a very important part in this, and especially when you have media personalities or leadership in the media, or even the media people themselves who understand the context and who are already on the ground, as Mary said, those Somali journalists. I mean, when things got worse, for example, I want to share a story whereby when things got worse around December, I was in one village in Jubaland next to the border of Kenya, and that week there was a former BBC journalist, Abdirizak Atosh, who was on the ground, and he was really broadcasting and putting this in his Twitter and Facebook, and you know, for us as an agency, that we could pick quickly what the people really needed. I mean, he was very much in touch with the local administration, he was very much in touch with the local people, and in fact, it told us more than even what we could easily gain through, you know, normal assessment. So working closely with the media and highlighting the information in the media and using especially the social media platform help make us Somalis who are outside the country to be aware. I mean, we have seen areas in Gedo, which is one region within Puntland. The first response was done by Somali diaspora who, you know, were sending money through some Somali, bloggers. So this is very helpful. And as you said, I think changing the narrative and allowing the locals to take the leadership, allowing, you know, introducing the government leadership into this and working closely with them really has got a big advantage in terms of response and support to these communities.
Thanks, Dawood. Nimo, Dawood mentioned the diaspora. That is an interesting sort of group of people to bring in sort of talking about the crisis. How do you think we can, engage them more, to really make sure that the narratives are shaped by Somalis, both those who are still in the country or those who are in the diaspora?
Diaspora groups have played a big role in Somalia in various different sectors, whether it's business, creating business within the country, also supporting their families at the household level, but also when crises are really big, coming together and ensuring that they are supporting the communities who are the hardest hit. I think it's slowly developing. I've attended a couple of diaspora organization meetings to see how they can support. And I think that's areas that we can leverage in bringing them on board and bringing them to the coordination meetings and ensuring that they have the information necessary as well for what support is needed, so that we're complementing each other in terms of our response. As many people have said before, I think the situation is different with COVID, and I think maybe that's definitely also impacted the diaspora within their home countries, where some people have lost their jobs, or this increasing prices of cost of living as well might be impacting the diaspora communities. But I think that's definitely an area that we can leverage and ensure that we're bringing them and engaging them in the various different conversations. But their support to the household level continues to do that, whether it's family, relative of a relative, that continues as well. Even internally within the country, people are really supporting each other. And a lot of the time, this is where communities who are affected or households who are affected are mitigating the situation and continuing to live. We do need a bigger look at the bigger picture as well, in terms of looking at development aid. I mean, Somalia has been in crisis for 30 years. We've been here time and time again. And how can we ensure that there's more development funding going into the country? There's more investment to ensure that we're building programs that are resilient and empowering the communities to withstand these shocks that will inevitably reoccur because of the climate change and the impact of climate change. So I think it's very important that we're having those conversations in the long term, kind of moving away from these silos of life-saving interventions, absolutely necessary at this time, but ensuring at the same time we are building in the development and resilience programs as well.
Thank you so much, Nimo. Simon, you want to come back on that?
Very quickly, on Daoud was giving the example of the Somali diaspora and how they were the first people helping. I think it's really important for listeners to understand this isn't a one-off event. This is what happens every single time there is a problem. It's the local business communities are collecting money and helping the people who need it. Diaspora is sending money and it's being organized. So, Sarah, you were asking about how do we report a crisis without white saviorism? Do we not report it? And I think the answer is no. Reporting about the crisis is very necessary. But the white saviorism comes when we present people as being sitting helpless, doing nothing, until we, the white saviors, come along and help them. But if the reporting is focused much more on what people are doing for themselves, how the local community is trying to help each other, but they can't do everything, they need extra resources, then I think we're able to present it in a respectful way, but also in a true way. This isn't make-believe, this is what really is happening.
Mel, you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question because I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist for 30 years, but I'm very confused about the role of the media in situations like this and what people kind of expect from the media. I don't think I'm here to change the world in any way. I'm here to try as honestly, fairly and accurately to tell the story about what's happening, and then audience makes up their mind what to do. I'll just make one quick point about, in terms of media coverage, I think the media basically can only cope with one humanitarian crisis at a time. When I walked in here, the TV, wall to wall, Ukraine, that's all you see. And it's kind of like the media and the audience don't have an appetite for another humanitarian crisis. Plus Africa, at least in terms of international media, is very, very much down the agenda. But in terms of what, as a journalist, you can do, this conversation reminds me of during the 2011-2012 crisis, I went to an IDP camp in Somalia and I wanted to ask people about the situation. They screamed at me, told me to get out when they heard I was a journalist. They thought I was an aid worker. They said, what is the point of us wasting our time speaking to you? You come here, you ask us questions, you film us, and then nothing. You just take stuff from us. And I try to explain, maybe people will see the report and take some action, but they didn't want anything. And then you get the other side when it's like, why aren't you doing more? Why does 80% of the people in Britain not even know that there's this problem in the Horn of Africa? So I would really like to know from the panel, what can the media do? What is the role of the media in a situation like this?
Well, we have a question from a leading journalist, Nimo Daoud. I think this is really for you to answer. Nimo, maybe I'll ask you first.
Yeah, thank you so much. And Mary, absolutely right. Those conflicting feelings towards journalists are certainly there in various different levels and different communities. And, you know, you can understand from the point of view of the communities as well. They've been, you know, in this situation, IDP Somalia has been where it is at the moment for 30 years, and you know, journalists have been flying in and flying out, and sometimes that did not materialize for the community in terms of better change for their lives. But I think it's really important that we tell these stories. I mean, journalists play a very important role in telling this story of these communities to the world. And the British public have a right to know what's happening in the Horn of Africa. 80%, that's a huge number. And we're talking about 18 months of this crisis unfolding and just getting worse and worse by the day. So I think we journalists do have a responsibility to report on the situation for the public to know. And also maybe for public to put pressures on their governments and to hold their politicians accountable as well, and asking these questions. In fact, you know, it could be the questions of, well, we've been support, or the government in the UK has cut down aid drastically to Africa as well. So I think it's really vitally important that international media, in partnership with the Somali media, tell the story of those communities. It's also very important that money or those resources are being used in a way to ensure that there's long-lasting solutions to these communities. Over to you.
Thanks, Nimo. Daoud.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. I concur with Nimo. And Mary, I want to say media remains the most, according to me, as an actor on the ground, the most important channel to communicate and show the world what is really happening on the ground. I mean, without media, we will not be able to see the dire situation in Southwest State, the dire situation in Gedo, the dire situation in Jubaland. And the media, to be honest, for me, is the influencing piece. Is that piece which can give this information and the facts to anyone across the globe. I, as you have rightly said, the situation and the coverage around the world has really been captured by the Ukraine situation, which is a real situation and has to be reported rightly. But you see, what's happening is some very dire situation like the ongoing famine situation in the Horn is being forgotten. So media now also is not only about television. You know, we are seeing the social media, the use of social media, Facebook, Twitter, you know, all this. And as actors, we continue to communicate with the media, both at international and local level. I mean, we have seen some of the initial reactions and support from the Somali diaspora came because of Somali local journalists reporting the situations in specific areas through their either Twitter or Instagram and other channels. So yes, it remains important. And I just finally want to say also, media help us influence the donors. I mean, we have just seen some developed countries like the US now announcing new allocations. And we believe some of us, like Mexico, has been doing a lot of advocacy together with main media channels. And we believe that remains to be important. But as you earlier said, I think it's important to have the right narrative, to have the right leadership, African leadership, getting this narrative and doing more so that they can present the real situation on the ground. Back to you.
This is an incredibly important point, though. Thank you. We're pretty much at time, but Simon, one final comment from you on the challenge of cutting through the noise of the coverage of the Ukraine conflict. I know you have a blog coming out on this today. What do you think we can do more?
It might not be possible to change the media focus on the Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine is obviously a huge story for the media for lots and lots of reasons, partly because it affects us so much in our own security here in Western Europe. But also it's a story with a story and with a clear narrative. I'm more worried actually in the response of the international humanitarian community to the Ukraine compared to Somalia, because that's something that it's not about whether we influence, that's something about what we ourselves are doing. Now, what is going on in Ukraine? I mean, it is terrible and the suffering there is terrible. It is not a humanitarian crisis in the sense of a crisis which needs international humanitarian agencies. Yeah, they have no business in being there. The Ukraine is still a functioning state, and it is quite properly, being supported with enormous amounts of funds, for example, from the European Union, going straight to the country. So the state institutions can provide the same healthcare service that they provided, the social protection benefits which they've always provided. That's all ongoing. The same, the refugees who have fled the Ukraine, or in the neighbouring countries, or even here in the UK, quite rightly, they've been given the right to work, they've been given access to all the normal welfare benefits that everyone can get, and all of that's right. So the role of humanitarian agencies, simply not there. One of the first principles of humanitarian action is that we are supposed to go and give aid according to need. Now, it is impossible, and this will not be popular, I know, with many agencies. The agencies have launched here in the UK, there's been this major appeal where the agencies come together and they've had this big appeal for the Ukraine. So it's not just what the story which the media is telling, which is focused on the Ukraine. Humanitarian agencies are asking the public to give money for the Ukraine. They're not asking the public to give money for the Horn of Africa. I mean, I'm horrified by that, because much of the people in Ukraine are suffering and they need our support, our political support, etc., etc. I'm not arguing against that. But you don't have 250,000 children who are about to die there. You don't have people who have no access to any forms of support because they have states who are looking after them. So for me, the big worry, as I say, is not so much the media attention to the Ukraine. It's more around what we ask. We need to put our own house in order. We need to get our priorities right. And we need to be saying to the public, yes, we appreciate your generosity, because the public time and time again have shown themselves willing not just to help one crisis, but to help lots and lots of people, local charities and so on, and food banks, etc., etc. And we need to be saying, thank you for worrying about the people in Ukraine. The government's looking after that. Please give your money to people who need it more, and that's in the whole of Africa.
Thank you so much, Simon, Mary, Nemo, and Daoud. This has been an incredibly insightful conversation. And thank you to our listeners. I hope that the conversation today will help bring a bit more attention to this crisis. I think we've heard very clearly that the crisis is already, you know, very acute, and it is urgent to act. And so if you are listening, please help bring attention to the crisis. Please, you know, help raise alarm to mobilize action that is really urgent. Remember to subscribe to the show, comment, feedback, rate the show, help us, you know, amplify these discussions. We are on all your favorite podcast providers. Until next time, thank you for listening.